but in the most endearing way. He could totally relate because he came from similar roots as me. From there, Brett and I became fast friends. He's Italian, he's from New Jersey. He reminded me of the guys I hung out with back home. Brett is more outgoing than I am, so he knew a lot of people and he started introducing me around. I needed the help. I'm no mover and shaker, I'm quiet. It's not ideal for any performer to have a wall up, but I couldn't change who I was. I think some people in the comedy world saw me as standoffish, but that's not it. I'm like a cat. Prefer to hang in the back and wait for people to come to me. Working at the lounge and running from show to show was taking a toll. The grind was wearing me down. There are only so many hours in the day, and given the choice between doing a shift or a set, I'd always do the set. With fewer hours at the Four Seasons, I earned less and had to dip into my savings. The cushion I diligently stuffed away shrank down to nothing. And then I made that fatal mistake of relying on credit cards to get by. Bo was a guy I met doing extra work on Days of Our Lives. He recruited me to sell satellite TV subscriptions out of a mall in South Central LA. He actually told me that he put the BO in HBO. I entertained the idea because I could work days and I thought I could make more money. This mall had been within spitting distance of the Rodney King riots. I realized on my first day that the population of this mall wasn't flush with disposable cash. But I thought, with my determination and showmanship, I'd do well. My take would be $100 per subscription. I figured on a bad day, I'd make $300. I stood in that rolling kiosk, using every trick in the book to attract customers. I remember recording Michael Jackson's 30th anniversary special and playing that on a loop on the kiosk TV. At one point, there's about 100 people at my kiosk doing the moonwalk and spins onto their tippy toes. But none were reaching into their pockets to spring for a dish. I learned that people who could barely afford their rent did not want to pay up front for a year of TV. Especially when they could come get this type of entertainment at the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza for free. From July through September of 2001 and into the holiday season, I sold a grand total of 10 subscriptions. My work ethic was so damn strong, I actually went into the mall to open up the kiosk after hearing the news of the planes hitting the Twin Towers. Every store in the mall had their gates pulled down while I was opening up the shutters for my kiosk. I was afraid that if I took a day off, I would get fired and disappoint the dish franchise manager, or even worse, Bo. Around that time, I was on the phone with my mother when she asked, "How's it going?" Concern had started to seep into her voice, like she knew something was going on without my having to tell her. I guess telling her I wasn't flying home for Christmas that year kind of gave it away. "Yeah, everything's good," I lied. "Work's all right?" "Yeah, work's good." "How's your money holding out?" "Well," I said, "money is... it's bad, Ma. I owe 10 grand on my credit card." I blurted out the awful truth before I could stop myself, and then I started to cry. The floodgates opened up. I was trying to compose myself, and I didn't realize she passed the phone to my father, and he said, "Hey." I took a deep breath, exhaled slowly, and braced myself for an onslaught of, "What's wrong with you?" "Your mother told me," he said. "I'm sorry, Dad. I just couldn't." "Sebastian," he said sharply, "it's all right. You fucked up. It's okay. You're young. You're allowed. Now listen to me. I don't want you to worry. I'm going to cover the 10 grand. "What?" It was the last thing I expected to hear from him. I blubbered, "You are? Your balance with the credit card company as of now is zero." "Oh my God, I don't know what to say. Your balance with me is 10 grand. "No, I'll pay you back," I said. "Every dime, I swear. You gotta start being smart with your money." "I will be. And Dad," I said, swallowing back a new rush of tears, "thank you." He paused. "You're welcome," he said. All the people I'd met, all the shows I'd done, in that one conversation, I realized how superficial it all was. My parents' love for me, and mine for them, was the real thing. This one phone call was the most honest, raw, unflinching reveal of myself I'd allowed in years. I was having success on stage and making people laugh, but in one conversation I realized that I hadn't even begun to make comedy that was from my heart, that would touch other people and resonate in a deeper place than some bit about competitive shopping. And now I was fired up to reassess my priorities and reimburse my father. No more restaurant meals, nice clothes, or gimmicky business cards. I put everything I earned towards Salvatore Maniscalco Payback Fund. I wasn't going anywhere or doing anything until I paid him back. I went back to the Four Seasons and I told my manager I want to work as much as possible, any shift they had. It was an uncomfortable echo of what I used to say to Mitzi at the Comedy Store. "I could give you 3 shifts a week," he said. "I'll take it." I worked Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then I showed up Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday in my uniform and pulled the old trick of waiting by the punch clock for all the other cocktail waitresses to come in, so I could convince them to give me their shifts too. Some weeks, I worked 7 nights and 80 hours. I started sending my father checks, $200 a month, whatever I could afford. I would pay my bills, put aside some cash for living expenses, and then write him a check for the rest. My Comedy Store hours were next to nil. After 6 months of this, I called and asked my father, "How much do I owe you?" "Hold on," he said. He kept the ledger down to the penny. "Let's see, you sent $300 last week, bringing your balance to $7,300. At this pace, in 2 years, we'll be square." Not for one moment did I ever resent Dad for holding me to every penny. I wouldn't have had it any other way. I didn't want a handout. I believe if you screw up, you can't just skate. There's no free meals, free tickets, or free rides in this life. I'm sure my mother urged him to let me off the hook, but I'm glad he didn't. My father was a hairstylist, not a banker. Writing me that check for 10 large had to hurt him, and that hurt me. I wanted to pay my father back so we would both hurt less. In the process, our relationship grew tighter and even more loving than before. He was happy to be there for me in need, and part of how he helped was to teach me to hold myself accountable. The love and humility of this experience changed me and my comedy. I was down to only 1 or 2 comedy store slots per week. Paradoxically, working less expanded my act. Since I wasn't going out, I had time to work on stronger material and was digging deeper for it, too. I started to notice a change in the laughs I was getting. They came from lower in the belly. Hearing the shift made me more comfortable, more confident. Time passed. I kept writing those monthly checks to my father and honing my new material. Finally, I got even with Dad and climbed to a new level of confidence as a performer. But it wasn't enough. By now, I'd been in L.A. for 5 years with not a lot to show for it. I couldn't see I was going to keep up for another 5 years. I'd been lucky enough to get as far as I had, but I knew I could go farther. If only I could catch a break. I was starting to feel impatient for it. And then finally, it came. Chapter 4. The Pizza Bagel. I met Andrew Dice Clay in the parking lot of the Comedy Store in 2002. I went outside after finishing my set one night and saw Wheels Parisi, the guy who recommended me to Mitzi Shore. He was having a conversation with somebody. Taking a closer look, I realized it was Dice, Mr. Hickory Dickory Dock. He had sold out Madison Square Garden twice, a rock star comedian. I couldn't believe I was hanging out in the parking lot with a guy I listened to and loved growing up. Dice was a very intimidating presence in all black, fingerless gloves, a big leather jacket, smoking aggressively. The look and demeanor said, don't even think about talking to me. I never want to impose myself on anybody. I typically wait until someone talks to me first and invites me in. I sure wasn't about to launch myself at dice with my hand out like a starstruck fan. Wheels noticed me, called me over, and made the introduction. Wheels and Dice went way back. He had been Dice's opening act in his heyday in the late 80s, early 90s, and they were still good friends. Dice drew on his cigarette, tilted his head toward me, and he said, hey, Cesare. I smiled and I nodded like I knew what he was talking about. But the whole time I was thinking, who the hell is Cesare? I'd heard that Dice gave everybody a nickname. Was he bestowing one on me so soon? What did it mean? I looked it up the moment I got home. Cesare is a character in the movie The Idolmaker. He's a busboy who the main character, played by Ray Sharkey, turns into a Fabian-like teen idol singer. I was a waiter. Not that Dice knew that, so it kind of made sense. Or not, I don't know, who knows. I was just meeting the guy for the first time. He would continue to call me Cesare for the next 6 months. So now I was part of the conversation in the parking lot. Not that I contributed much. It took about 3 minutes to understand that when you hang out with Dice, he dominates. When he'd say he'd seen my act and thought I was funny, I was stunned. I don't think I could have said anything anyway. In the upcoming weeks, I saw Dice from time to time at the Comedy Store. He would come up to do a pop-in set, hang out for a while. One night, he pulled me aside and he asked, what are you doing this weekend? It's always funny when somebody asks you if you're free before telling you why. I prefer someone to lead in with the activity, and then I could let them know if I'm free or not. If it's, you want to help me move? Then my answer is, no, I'm busy. But if you're having something fun and cool to do, then I got nothing going on. I don't know, I said to Dice. Coming here, working. I'd like you to open up for me at the Stardust Theater in Vegas. Let me think. Take orders in the lounge or do comedy with Dice on the legendary Las Vegas Strip? So far, the biggest gig I ever done was in the original room at the Comedy Store. The Stardust Theater held 1,000 people, and Dice was asking me to do stand-up there. Something else now made sense. Apparently, Dice had come looking for me at the lounge the night before. I went into work the next day, and my coworker told me, Andrew Dice Clay was here looking for you. Really? Yep. Gloves and all. I told him it was your night off. I said yes to the Dice invite, of course. My only tiny hesitation was that Dice and I hadn't spent much time together. I didn't know what to expect of him in Las Vegas, although I could imagine we'd be hitting some clubs every night. My only lengthy social interaction with him so far had been after my set at the Comedy Store, when he said to me, "Let's go to Canner's Deli." He's got an Italian look and attitude, but he actually is Jewish. And he likes a nice bowl of matzo ball soup. I mean, who doesn't? So at midnight, we went into Canner's Deli. I intended to pick his brain about stand-up, but I didn't even have to ask. We sat down, we ordered some soup, and Dice regaled me with stories for about an hour. Another time, I just come home from a closing shift at the Four Seasons, and my cell phone rang. It was Dice. Calling to shoot the shit at 1:30 a.m. I mean, he never called me before, and I never called him. I had no idea how he even got my number. I was still relatively new to Hollywood and to comedy, and a guy I watched growing up was calling me in the middle of the night to chat. It was surreal. As I got to know him better, I learned that Dice is a night owl. When the whole world was asleep, he was wide awake. He often reached out to people to keep him company on the phone. I was exhausted, but it didn't matter. I didn't need to talk. With Dice, you just listen. The Stardust, as you probably know, was a classy Rat Pack era casino. When you walked in, you could almost picture Frank and Dean walking through the place in sharkskin suits. By the time I performed there, though, it was kind of run down. In fact, it would be demolished a few years later. But I didn't care. I never would have thought I'd be doing a gig at the same place where Scorsese filmed Casino, or share the stage with the Dice Man. The theater itself was a semicircle with hundreds of half-moon-shaped booths with black faux leather upholstery, the kind that hiss when you sat on it, set in rows like a stadium seating. It sat 1,000 people, but it still felt intimate. A runway of a stage shot right through the middle of the room, so if Dice or Wayne Newton himself wanted to go out into the audience, he had that option. At that point in my career, I didn't even consider doing that. I was just happy to be on the actual stage itself. I was thrilled about getting paid $150 per show on top of the hotel room and a per diem for food. All I had to do was a 15-minute set to warm up Dice's fans. For the same amount of earnings, I would have to spend 5 to 8 hours on my feet at the Four Seasons, serving beef sliders and dirty martinis. When Dice and I first arrived at the Stardust, he said, "Check in, then come back out." Huh? I don't know, I thought we'd spend the day by the pool, have a couple of drinks, but no. Dice had other plans. "We're going furniture shopping today," he said. I wasn't expecting that. A nightclub, a strip bar? I could see those, but a furniture store? Sure enough, he took me to Christ, a high-end furniture showroom, and he made me sit on every couch they had. "What do you think? Lay down. Test it out," he said. "Nice, every couch is more comfortable than what I got in my fucking apartment. I pulled mine off the street. This one cost $7,000. Because Dice was performing regularly at the Stardust, he'd purchased a house in Vegas, and it was completely empty. So I was brought on to be his opener and his interior decorator. We looked at carpeting together, bathroom fixtures, rugs, and kitchenware. Dice had a thing about asking salespeople for discounts. "What's the pro deal?" he always asked. The salespeople were baffled, as I was. "The fuck is a pro deal?" I asked him. It was the Fame markdown. He even put the screws on a kid working at Foot Locker. The kid said there was no discounts, but Dice pushed it. "What do you pay for the shoes?" "The employee discount," he said. The sales kid was completely confused. "But you're not an employee." He looked him in the eye and he said, "I'm Dice. I don't understand. I'm Dice." He was goofing on the kid, putting on a comedy show to get a laugh out of me. To him, it was a game to goof and mess around with people. Another time, he went to the grocery store, and he put hundreds of dollars worth of snacks and drinks on the conveyor belt. Seeing how big a purchase it was, the cashier asked, "Do you have a club card, sir?" Dice said, "How much?" "With the club card, you get a 10% discount." "How much?" Totally deadpan. "It only takes about a minute to fill out the..." "How much?" The cashier didn't get it. The people behind were complaining, and Dice just kept saying the same thing. I remember dying laughing at the chaos he would create with just two words. If anybody else came through with hundreds in groceries, they would want the 10% off and would sign up for the card. But Dice, he didn't need the discount. He didn't need the pro deal on the furniture or the shoes. But he couldn't resist busting somebody's balls or getting a laugh out of whoever was with him. He's a character. I think Dice sees the world as existing for his amusement, and he takes advantage of it. And I took advantage of being in his orbit. Earning $150 per set was mind-blowing for me at the time. Just to give you an idea of how broke I was when I toured with Dice, the Stardust gave me a per diem of $100 a day for food and beverages. I'd buy a small lunch before the show, and then after the show, we'd all go out to dinner, which got comped. So it wasn't easy to spend the full $100. I had to come up with creative ways to maximize the per diem. So, in the morning, I'd call room service and order 2 eggs, bacon, and a bottle of Jack Daniels. The booze would get me up to $100. I wasn't going to waste a penny of that stipend. If I was in Vegas for 5 nights, I'd order 5 bottles of alcohol in total. The room service guy would give me the eye like, damn, you're hardcore. Then I'd pack the vodka, gin, and Jack into my suitcase and bring it back to L.A. and stock the bar in my apartment. Surprise bonus of the Stardust? One night in Vegas, I met Mr. Warmth, Don Rickles. He did the early show and Dice was the late show. So there I was in his dressing room talking to the guy I watch on Carson that I'd stayed up past my bedtime in the early 80s to watch. I never miss Rickles on The Tonight Show. Every time he was on, it was like lightning in a bottle. His chemistry with Carson was electric. Rickles had the ability to make fun of everyone around him and still make the person feel like $1 million. There will never be another like him. I opened up for Dice for 2 years, not every single weekend, but very consistently, in Vegas and all over the U.S. Hanging out with him was like a doctorate in comedy. We would do casinos in the middle of nowhere, say in Tacoma, Washington, and we had long midnight discussions in his hotel room or the lobby bar about stand-up, what to do, what not to do. At the time, a lot of people I came up with at the Comedy Store were getting TV shows and movie parts. Dice told me not to worry about what other people were getting. Just be patient and wait your turn, he said. You can't compare your career to your friend's career. Everybody has their own path. The only thing you have control over is your material and your stage time. The rest will take care of itself. It might come next week. It might come in 20 years. You don't know when it's going to happen. But it never will if you get distracted by what your friends are doing. I took that advice to heart. I always felt like I was a step behind, or like everyone in my class of comedy was getting A's on the test and I was just squeaking by with a C. High school all over again. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't know what I needed to do to get up to that level. And here was a guy who'd been on the top of the mountain and he was telling me, stop worrying and run your own race. He was running his own race too. Although Dice wasn't as hot in 2002 as he had been in the late 80s, he drew crowds. But now it was theaters, not stadiums. He was still dreaming big. He wanted to get back to Madison Square Garden. He wanted to do TVs and movies. No doubt, he'd get there. Dice loved to talk. He could go for hours at a time, and I soaked it all up. He knew a lot more than I did about the business, and I was grateful just to listen to what he had to say. I always thought that you never learn a lot when you're speaking. But if you shut up and listen, you could pick up a few things, especially from people around you who are more successful than you and have been where you want to go. Sometimes, though, I had to sift through his advice to make sure his suggestions were right for me. I got an idea for you, Cesare, he said once. Great, what is it? Think you need a prop. A prop? I don't know, something that hypes up the audience. Starts them laughing even before you say a word. Get you a free laugh. Okay. Should put a sack down your pants. Just go out there with this magnificent cock. You don't even acknowledge it. You don't even say a word. You just go right into your Starbucks bit or whatever. Audience will go nuts. You don't think that will be distracting? I asked. Who cares? It's funny. It is funny. I'll think about it. Thanks. I did think about it. I even rolled up a sweat sock and stared at it, wondering, should I? As a young comedian, for a split second, I thought, wait, does he even know what he's talking about? It was entirely possible he was setting me up, too. In the end, I decided not to do it. My comedy wasn't about bulging cocks. That was Dice's style. Even with his crowd at his shows, I still had to be me. My arrangement with Dice wasn't a formal thing. He was going on tour, he'd call me, I drop everything and go with him. If I didn't hear from him in a while, I would panic a bit and look up his schedule to see if he had anything coming up. Once you play those big rooms, it's hard to go back to 100-seat clubs. But it wasn't only the adrenaline rush and the money and the bottles of Jack that I craved. When I was on the road with Dice, I was a working comedian. I was supporting myself doing the act. That had been my dream, and with him, I was living it. During the down times, I could have called them up and asked them about upcoming gigs, but I felt more comfortable waiting to be asked. When the call came in, I instantly do the math. 5 shows at $150 each was $750. A fortune for me at the time. I can't say that every minute with Dice was sunshine and roses, though. I learned some lessons about touring the hard way. His fans were volatile, hardcore. There were some couples, but it was primarily men. There was always a lot of aggression in the room. Before the show started, the crowd would chant, "Dice! Dice! Dice!" Into this ocean of testosterone, I'd come out and do 15 minutes about Ross Dress for Less. Our acts were kind of similar in tone, but our material couldn't have been more different. Usually, the crowd would just put up with me. The occasional insult was hurled at me, but nothing too bad. One night, at the Silver Legacy Casino in Reno, his fans were outright hostile. As soon as I came out, they started screaming, "Dice! Dice! Dice!" at a scary volume. The volume of their talking never died down while I was on stage. A bunch of them started shouting out at me. It was too loud to make out any of the specific comments, but I got the idea. It rattled me, and that only made it worse. You couldn't show any sign of weakness to this crowd. They'd smell blood in the water like sharks and attack. At that time, I didn't have the ability to go back at them. I just got nervous, cut my set short, and walked off. I went backstage, and when Dice saw me, he started yelling, "What the fuck? Why'd you get off early?" he asked. He was pissed off. I didn't realize it was such a big deal to cut my act by 5 minutes. I was thinking, that's it. I'm done. I'm never getting asked back to do this again. After the show, we hugged it out, and he said, "You cannot bail early. Whatever's happening up there, you have to handle it. You can't let them rattle you. You have to be in control of your own act. I'm counting on you to get that crowd warmed up and to do a certain amount of time. I'm in the back thinking you're going to do 15. If you get off after 11, I have to go on earlier, and that fucks me up too. Now that I'm a headliner, I understand exactly what he meant. I have a pre-show checklist that I have to run through before I go out there. I mean, it's nothing elaborate. I make sure I didn't miss a belt loop. I have my tour manager, Georgie, shine a flashlight on my teeth to check for pieces of food. I have a Halls to soothe my throat. But I need to go through the ritual or it can mess up my rhythm. If you're scheduled to do 15, you do 15. You don't chicken out and walk off because the crowd isn't nice to you. If thousands of rabid fans are screaming, 'Get off the stage!' it takes epic courage to stand your ground. You are completely alone up there. So alone. You can try to convert them, or just get through it regardless, but you have to stick it out until the bitter end. That night, I was mad at myself for letting the crowd shake me up. They got to me. It would be years before I mastered the art of dealing with drunks, hecklers, and people shouting out during my act. Any rumbling in the audience is a sign that you're losing control, and it could spread too. If one drunk yells "you suck," and most of the audience likes the show, they'll drown them out quick. But if you're not connecting from the get-go and someone starts yelling, the whole crowd can turn on you. If you have a minute, Google Bill Burr Philadelphia, and you'll see an example of a comedian in a hostile environment and people booing who would not cave. He stood up there, insulting the crowd right back, counting down the minutes until his time was up. He did not buckle, and kept a furious stream of vicious, hilarious insults flowing minute after minute. In the end, he won the crowd over. You could see what a seasoned pro he was up there. The night I bailed in Reno, I was only 5 years in, and I'd been doing small rooms, open mics, and bringer shows. I'd never seen a large, hostile crowd like that before. Now I have 20 years' experience under my belt, and I could deal with any tense situation. About 1 in 20 shows, I have to come back at somebody. You can't plan what you're going to say beforehand. Every time is different, and you have to react in that moment. But here's how I handle certain types of incidents. Drunk idiots. Recently, a wasted guy was getting heated with someone he thought was in his seat. I looked down at him and said, "Aren't you embarrassed?" The crowd laughed, and the guy sat down and shut up. Screaming jerk-offs. Nowadays, with social media, people feel like they have to participate in everything. And you get someone shouting out random shit. I go, "I'm doing a show up here. You mind?" Insecure assholes. A certain type of macho guy feels threatened if his date laughs at my jokes, so he tries to say something funny to impress her. I can spot the Neanderthal type easily, and I know how to massage his ego. I say, "Look at this guy. I'm not even going to bother with this guy. He looks like he could kill me with his right hand." It's a compliment. Not that he deserves it, but he'll instantly settle down if you acknowledge his guns. Opening for Dice exposed me to every conceivable type of rough audience, as individuals and as a seething mass in large venues. In that way, touring with him was like a 2-year boot camp. I needed the training to learn how to handle adversity, how to deal with different groups of people. I developed the skills on stage, but what I learned applied to all aspects of life, off stage as well. Stay calm, keep your best stuff, meet your commitments no matter what. Back then, the growing pains of stand-up were tough to get through, but worth it. I must have thanked Dice 100 times for the opportunities and the experiences. Along with sharing his wisdom, Dice and I became friends during this period. He even invited me to his son's bar mitzvah, and I went to parties at his house in Vegas. Our friendship was a bit one-sided. I don't know if I gave anything to him, or if I was just part of his entourage. He seemed to like the loose connection, and, as I've said, I was just happy to be there. The end was like a slow fade-out. I wouldn't get a call for 3 weeks, then 6 weeks. Then Dice decided to take a long break, and I never got asked to open for him again. When he picked up comedy touring sometime later, he used other acts. I didn't take it personally. I reminded myself something Dice told me, about not comparing myself to others or wishing that I had what they had. Just focus on the comedy and what happened on stage. Stay hungry and be patient. Good things were on the way. I just didn't know what or when. It's been 15 years since my time with Dice. And now I'm in the position to tap up-and-coming comedians to be my opening acts. Sometimes the venue makes that decision, but usually I get to choose. For a while, I requested tapes from 4 local comedians, and I would pick one. But for the last few years, I've toured with one main guy, Pat McGann. In 2010, I had a gig headlining at Zany's Comedy Club on Wells Street in downtown Chicago. The venue set up the feature act and the MC. Pat was the featured act. He likes to tell the story of the day of the show, how he saw me walking down the street and came up to me and said, "Hey, I'm opening up for you tonight." I was in my own head, and I apparently looked at him like he was crazy before my brain caught up and realized who he was. Later he said, "I didn't want to interrupt you," which reminded me of when I met Dice and didn't want to go up to him and talk to him at all. Pat and I got along well at Zany's. When I returned to Chicago to tape my comedy special, Aren't You Embarrassed, at the Harris Theater, the venue recommended an opener for me. Pat again. Clearly, the universe was trying to put us together. I liked the way he acted backstage, friendly but giving me a lot of space, which I need to clear my head. Like I said, I have a pre-show ritual, and they don't include chatting with people. He mostly stays in his dressing room doing his own thing. His attitude is like mine. We were there to work. What sealed it for me was that he sent a thank you note. I didn't even hire him for the gig, and he thanked me anyway. It reminded me of all the handwritten thank you notes I had sent coming up. To every person I auditioned for or interviewed with for comedy gigs, acting jobs, waiter jobs. My personalized note didn't seem to get me far, but receiving one from Pat convinced me we were on the same page. He was always appreciative of the work. With me, a little gratitude goes a long way. After another show we did, he gave me two bookends, the lion statues from the Art Institute of Chicago. The thought was nice, but I would have to ship all 75 pounds of them back to L.A. They probably needed a crate. So, in all reality, thanks from my father, Pat, because they're at his house with books on Sicily sandwiched between them. FYI, all up-and-coming comedians, shelve the arrogance for 5 minutes and write thank you notes or send small gifts to the headliners who hire you. It won't work out on everyone, but it could turn the tide. I know what I'm getting with Pat. I know his act. I know he's going to make my audiences laugh. He's not going to swear or tell any rough jokes. He doesn't do crowd work, like asking someone in the audience, "Hey, where are you from?" As a headliner, you don't want the opener who gives the crowd permission to talk to the comedian. When I come out, if I decide I'm going to interact with them, fine. The opener's job is to go out there, get the crowd warm, and then get off stage. Pat does exactly what he's supposed to do. He also is intuitive and a good reader of social cues. If someone comes onto the tour bus or into my dressing room to talk about personal or business matters, Pat knows to politely excuse himself. You don't have to explain things to him. For instance, while on tour, I'm not a guy who likes to hang out after the show, and Pat could read when I want to grab a dinner and a glass of wine with him, or when to say goodnight and let us go our separate ways. You know, plus he's a great guy, a family guy with a wife and 3 kids, with huge potential. I want to help him out in any way I can, by producing a special for him or introducing him to club owners and bookers. It goes back to what Dice did for me, exposing me to different audiences, taking me around. He lifted me out of my day job and gave me a little scratch for 2 years. So now I could pay it forward and give Pat a hand up. In 2015, Dice and I reconnected, thanks in part to my wife, Lana. She and I didn't know each other when I was in Dice's world, obviously, but she found him fascinating and she remembered her father loving him growing up. I showed her videos of him and told her some stories, and she said, "He sounds awesome. Give him a call." I said, "It's been years." "So what?" Through a mutual friend, I reached out to Dice to congratulate him on his resurgence. Just like he talked about in that hotel room in Las Vegas years ago, he'd made his way back to TV and movies. He appeared on Entourage, which made total sense to me since he'd always had his own. Blue Jasmine, an Oscar-winning movie by Woody Allen, and Martin Scorsese's Vinyl series on HBO. He invited me to go see his son's band at a bar in L.A. When I was opening up for him, his sons were 10 and 13. Now they're grown men in their 20s. I went down to see them play and hung out with Dice for a while. We didn't reminisce about the old times or update each other on what we were doing lately in our careers. We just talked about this and that, people we knew, movies, music, comedy. Dice is still a talker, but he mellowed out somewhat. The vibe was relaxed, chill. It would have been inappropriate to tell him what I'd been thinking. "You were right. I was patient, and I did what you said, and now I'm doing arenas too." Instead, I kept quiet, like the first time we met. I enjoyed being back in his orbit for a couple of hours. Just two old friends sitting together, listening to music, as if no time had passed at all. Chapter 5. Hot Dish. After touring with Dice, I thought everything would open up for me. I did notice a brief uptick in gigs, but nothing that propelled me to the top. In fact, after the blip of attention, I was right back where I was before the Stardust. For another 2 or 3 years, my comedy career stalled. I kept punching in at that Four Seasons, doing spots at the clubs, stagnating. To move up, I needed to impress the right audience. I knew where to find it. But as to how to get there, I was at a loss. In the early days, Dublin's Irish Pub on the Sunset Boulevard was the hottest room in comedy. On any given night, Justin Timberlake, Vince Vaughn, and all of young Hollywood would hang out. Dane Cook was the biggest comedian going, and Dublin's was like his comedy home. MySpace was very popular, and he was the first comedian to use social media to promote his act. He became a MySpace sensation, him and Tila Tequila. Whatever happened to her? If comedy in L.A. was like high school, Dublin's was the popular kid party, and I was the geek who snuck in and stood alone in the corner. I had heard about it, but I wouldn't have gone by myself to check it out. I was never the popular guy in school or in comedy. In both settings, I always felt like an outsider. In high school, I didn't play football. I played soccer. The football guys were popular. The soccer team was made up of the kids who weren't big enough for the gridiron or came from immigrant parents who hoped their son would be the next Diego Maradona. When popular kids' houses were TP'd on Halloween, my house didn't even get a square. If I was lucky, they would throw the empty cardboard roll on my father's lawn. In the comedy world, the popular kids were touring the country as headliners while I delivered chicken satays to table 142, my left pec adorned with a plastic name tag. Brad Ernst brought me with him to Dublin's one night, and I met the guys who ran the room, Ahmed Ahmed and Jay Davis. Nice guys, but they didn't fall all over themselves to give me spots. They had their stable of regulars, and only occasionally gave an opportunity to a newcomer. For a long time when I hung out there, I was in the room, but I wasn't part of it. I wasn't doing spots or mingling or scoping out the VIPs. Most of Dublin's regulars were invited to Montreal's Just for Laughs Comedy Festival to do a showcase for up-and-comers called New Faces. A lot of them got network development deals and roles on TV. It was a common path for a lot of now-famous comedians to take. Not me. I was on an island, it seemed, and I was never a new face. I was a no-face. Even other guys who weren't popular were doing more than I was getting up on that stage. They would approach the plugged-in guys to ask, "Can I get a spot?" Very often, they could schmooze their way on stage. But what did they do when they got there? That was the question. Being an excellent networker didn't necessarily mean you were a great comedian, and vice versa. My style was to let my act speak for itself. If the guys who ran hot rooms liked what they saw of my act at the comedy store, then they would invite me to perform at their space. Even if I saw room runners at the store, it was like pulling teeth to go over to them and say, "I want to do your show, man." I would wait to be asked while stewing in frustration. But Dublin's in 2004 wasn't just any room. If there was ever a moment for me to overcome my discomfort about going up to people and asking for favors, it was then and there. If I couldn't get something going and soon, I would have to ask myself the tough questions like, am I really good enough? Am I wasting my time? Will I ever get away from the Windows Lounge with its nut munching and bad tippers? As uncomfortable as I felt about pushing myself on others, I had to start doing it, or the invitations I was waiting for might never come. One night, I approached Ahmed, and I said, hey, I'd love to do your show. Done. I did it. Ahmed was dealing with 200 comedians who would love to do his show, but he didn't shut me down. I took that as a good sign. He and I started talking, and I became a more visible presence at Dublin's. The next week, he gave me a spot, which was a very nice surprise. When I got up there, my set was funny enough to be asked back. It was like a combo of letting my act speak for itself and putting myself on the line. Even after I got piped in at Dublin's, though, I didn't overstep. Some guys would basically walk off stage after a set and go right up to Ahmed and ask for another. I would give it a little time, maybe 3 or 4 weeks. Then I would ask to do it again rather than be one more pest buzzing around his face. I didn't grow up hearing the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I grew up being told, grease your own wheel. For that matter, make your own wheel and grease from scratch. Don't rely on other people to do you any favors. Don't ask for things. Don't be a nuisance. In my mind, working the room and networking would take time and energy away from comedy, and that would not serve me in the long run. I saved up my courage for when I was on stage. If I had the gift of gab, it's possible I would have gotten a break earlier, but looking back, I think I needed those 7 years of warming up before I was ready to get hotter than I was. It was a process, a long one. So one night, I was at Dublin's, heading for the stairwell where you waited before you went on stage. The space was small and cramped. Maybe 3 people could fit back there at once. That night, when I walked up the stairs, I saw 2 other guys who were already there. One of them was Vince Vaughn. Back in 1996, when I was a senior in college, my dad had clipped an article in the Chicago Sun-Times about 2 guys going rogue on a mission to make a movie. My father said, look at these guys. They hardly had any money and no permits, and they're shooting on the side of this highway. They went to Las Vegas and almost got arrested. But look at what they did. The 2 guys were Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau. The movie was Swingers, which was so funny, ballsy, and fresh. Ever since then, I was a huge fan. Now flash forward to 2004 in the stairwell at Dublin's. I'm crammed into a tiny crawl space with all 6'5" of Vince. He said, you're from Chicago, right? I'm from Chicago. It started to feel like being from Chicago was the key that unlocked every huge opportunity I ever had. Vince and I started talking about where we grew up. He was from Lake Forest, a well-to-do neighborhood. Sports, the Bears, the Bulls, just bullshitting about Chicago and our teams. He was at Dublin's often because he and Ahmed were good friends going way back. In 1990, they were in The Fourth Man, a CBS school break special about teenage steroid use, also starring Peter Billingsley from A Christmas Story. Vince was a big supporter of Ahmed's stand-up and hung out at Dublin's when he was in town. I could see how they'd be such good friends. Like Vince, Ahmed made things happen. He was very entrepreneurial, starting comedy rooms and later organizing group tours. I'd heard some whispers that Vince wanted to bring a comedy show to places in the United States that wouldn't ordinarily be exposed to this type of entertainment. The concept was 30 cities, 30 shows, 30 nights on a bus. Some sketch, some celebrity guests, but the anchor of the show would be 4 stand-ups. Imagine my shock when soon after my encounter with Vince in the stairwell, Ahmed told me Vince wants you to do the Wild West comedy show. Now, I don't believe that my 5-minute conversation with Vince got me on the tour. I think Ahmed had a lot to do with it, for which I am eternally grateful. Vince probably asked him to recommend some people. I wouldn't have made the final cut if Vince didn't think I was funny. Along with me and Ahmed, the other comedians were Brett Ernst, whom I knew well from the Hustler Comedy Room, and John Caparulo, a Comedy Store regular I'd seen around but never gone out with socially. To put it in context how monumental this was, the tour was in 2005. In the previous 2 years, Vince had starred in Old School, Dodgeball, Anchorman, and The Wedding Crashers. The Breakup, his movie with then-girlfriend Jennifer Aniston, was coming out. He was on top of the world, one of the hottest names in Hollywood. He had 1 month off between movie shoots, and during that time, he wanted to do the Wild West tour. The logistics of it boggled the mind. We were booked to perform a show every night for 30 nights in a row at 1,500-plus seat venues in 16 states covering 6,000 miles of the heartland. Vince didn't pull it together himself. He had a team of 4 or 5 people handling all that, including his assistant, Sandra Smith, producers Peter Billingsley and his sister, Victoria, and publicist John Pisani. On top of all that, a camera crew would follow us around to make a documentary about the tour that would be released in theaters later on. The whole thing came together so quickly. 1 month after I got the call from Ahmed, we hit the road. Our first show was at the Fonda Theater in L.A. Big Hollywood types were in the audience, including director Taylor Hackford and Jon Favreau. Favreau, who'd become a major director himself, was opening the show by doing a Q&A on stage with Vince. I remember thinking, man, if I do well here in front of all these people in this crowd, hopefully some doors will open for me. I had a manager, and I invited him to come early to the show because the lobby would be prime hunting ground for him to talk me up and make some contacts. I had to go looking for him that night and found him outside the theater in the alley. He was drinking a beer out of a brown paper bag like a homeless person with another guy from the management company. I said, "What are you doing back here?" He said, "The drinks out in the lobby are expensive, so we went across the street to the liquor store." I wanted to say, "Get your ass back inside and mingle. The whole point of you being here was to get me some buzz." Their job was to schmooze and wangle opportunities for their clients, and these clowns were in the alley knocking down 40s. Needless to say, I changed management as soon as possible. My sister and her then-boyfriend, now husband, came to the show. I took them on the tour bus after. Vince had a room in the back, but the rest of us were in bunks that were the size of a coffin. Each bunk had a TV that flipped down so you could watch in bed, but if you rolled on your side, your shoulder would hit the bunk above you. The closed quarters never bothered me. I would have been happy in a van sleeping on the floor. When I stepped on that tour bus, I thought, fuck, this is it. I made it. Being on the road sure beat delivering 100 Cosmos at the hotel. For me, the bus might as well have been the presidential suite at the Four Seasons. The living room area had a place to eat, a TV, and gaming consoles. Video games were a big thing on tour. Vince was extremely good at Madden, the football game. He was smoking at the time, and he would light up on the bus. I have a bad reaction to cigarette smoke. Once I was sitting next to Vince playing a game at 4 a.m., and his cigarette smoke was really bothering me. I couldn't take it, so I went up in the front with the bus driver for a while. There was a little curtain that separated the driver's area from the rest of the bus, and Vince popped his head through and asked, "Where'd you go? What's wrong?" "The smoke is killing me," I said. "Well, I would have moved the cigarette into my other hand if you'd asked." 5 guys living on top of each other? Of course a few of us are going to get sick with the flu. Someone told me about a Z-Pack, which I've never done before. I grew up in a family where you do not take drugs unless they're prescribed to you. I have this fear of doing it, dying, and people weeping at the funeral, beating their chest, saying, "How could he have taken the Z-Pack without a prescription? Why?" The guys thought that was hilarious and shamed me into taking the pills. I felt much better. Thanks for asking. Vince was the ringleader, with a quick wit. He was another big talker. He didn't go off on endless monologues like Dice, though. Vince held court. He emceed on the bus and on the stage. I think he had a secret yearning to do stand-up, but he stuck with opening the show with sketches featuring special guests like Favreau, Justin Long, and Wedding Crashers co-star Kier O'Donnell. Vince is 6'5", handsome, and a presence. You could not look at him. Everywhere he went, he drew people's attention. And then when recognition sank in, they went into hysterics. Holy shit, is that Vince Vaughn? They'd ask each other. In Nowhere, Oklahoma, at a rest stop in the middle of the night, people mobbed him. It was like hanging out with Tom Cruise. He had to enter venues through the kitchen or there'd be mayhem. It was so exciting to be in public with him. I remember feeling disappointed when he decided to stay on the bus after a show instead of going out to the bars and the clubs with us. But he's with Jennifer Aniston then. He wasn't interested in meeting girls. When me and the other guys went out without him, girls would come up to us angling for an introduction to Vince. "You were so funny tonight," they'd say. "Huh, thanks." "Yeah, you were really great." "Huh, thanks again," we'd say, hopes rising. "So is Vince with you guys tonight?" Hopes dashed. That wasn't always the case. There were times when fans came up to me, Brett, John, and Ahmed, just to meet and hang out with us. But a lot of times, they were just working us to get to Vince. And I can't say that we blew off these women after we figured out their true intentions. There were many late nights out on tour partying and meeting new people. We ate ribs in Oklahoma, tacos in Texas, pulled pork in Kentucky, and cheesy chili in Wisconsin, sampling the specialty hot dishes wherever we went. But no matter how late we were out, you had to be back on the bus by curfew, or you'd have to pay your own way to the next gig. So if the bus left Alabama at 2 a.m. and you missed it talking to a girl at the bar, you would have to rent a car or hitchhike to the next city. I never missed curfew, because I didn't want to be the troublemaker. I did cut it close a few times, though. Vince got up every single morning at 5 or 6 o'clock to do radio interviews to promote the next gig. I remember the publicist coming on the bus at dawn saying, "Vince, we got a call." He'd take the phone into the parking lot and do 7 radio station spots back to back. There was no ad or promotional budget for the tour. The only way to publicize the gigs was for Vince to get on the phone and be funny on the radio. Drive time listeners learned that he'd be in their town tomorrow night and then they'd buy the tickets. Our shows would sell out on the power of those radio spots alone. I listened to him many mornings, putting the same energy and enthusiasm into each interview and never begging off, no matter how tired or hungover he might be. I thought, okay, this is how it works. You have to sell tickets. You have to convince people to come out, spend money, and give you a night of their lives. The work you do before the show is as important as the work you do at the show. A lot of comedians don't want to put in the time or get out of bed to sell tickets to their own shows, as if people will know who they are by magic. My takeaway from watching Vince in action was the big stars are big for a reason. They have the work ethic. They care enough about what they're doing to make it a success. Ever since that tour, I have followed his example and done whatever I can to promote. And after the show, for years to come, I would hang out in the lobby of the venue and shake hands with anyone in the audience who wanted to meet me. As I got more well-known, it would take hours, and I was happy to do it. If you've been playing gigs for 10 years without anyone remembering your name after the show, when you finally connected with fans, you would want to shake their hands and thank every one of them too. At the time, Brett and John had development deals with major networks. Ahmed toured nationally and internationally, and he ran comedy rooms. During an interview for the documentary film about the tour, Brett made a comment that I was where the other guys were 5 years ago, making it sound like I was the comedy novice to their grizzly veterans. But the truth is, we all started at the same time. No one had years on me, but they had gotten farther than me. I think that only made me more grateful to be with them. They're equal on tour. There was no jealousy or one-upmanship on the bus. Not a lot of shop talk either. We didn't discuss the art.